Okay, now the live stream should be up. Technology. Technology and religion. What a combination. Anyway, the point is I'd like to offer you the opportunity to get religious. You don't have to. I think that's important, is that I'm not going to push you, but I want to be clear that that's the topic of tonight, to potentially challenge some of our secularist attachments, our unwillingness to commit ourselves, unwillingness to let go and fully submerse ourselves in an experience. We're often afraid of religion, and rightly so. Religion can be pretty terrible. That's not the problem of the word religion or the category of religion. And I think that's the point, is that we can come up with Buddhist religion, and we have. And this is religion that, as Buddhists, we find palatable. It's religion. It shows that the problem is not with the category of religious activity, where you fully immerse yourself and fully commit yourself to something. The whole point is committing yourself to the right thing, which is, of course, the scary thing. How do you know what's right? So I'm going to go through it. And I think for many people, this isn't objectionable. For those of you who are Buddhists or Buddhist practitioners, we have what we call a ceremony to take on or to enter into the meditation practice. And this is what I went through when I first started meditating, and I've helped countless people and lots of people through the ceremony. I've stopped doing it since I've been in Canada, but not for any particular reason, except that we've been busy setting up the center. And it's the kind of thing you really need a staff, you need people to help you with, to really do a proper ceremony. But I'm going to go through the concept of the opening ceremony, or the ceremony to receive the meditation practice. It comes actually from the Visuddhimagga, and the tradition, the ancient tradition, on the sorts of things you need to set yourself in or settle yourself in before you practice meditation. So it's not just arbitrary. It's based, I guess, you could say, very much on the Arakka Kammatthana, the types of meditations that protect and support insight meditation. And you should recognize some of them as we go through it. The first thing you do, though, this is a very old tradition, this is from the Visuddhimagga and probably before, you give yourself up to the Buddha. You really do. Buddhists actually do this. I'd like to invite you all to think about this. Mahasi Sayadaw gives a good explanation in one of his books about how giving yourself up to the Buddha is a psychological support. It's putting your fate or your well-being in the hands of the Buddha. That's why we take refuge in the Buddha, because we think of the Buddha is someone great, someone powerful. I mean, it's the same sort of psychological benefit of putting your trust in God. Of course, there's no God up there, and there's certainly no Buddha up there who's going to hear your prayers. That's not the point. The point is the psychological, the commitment in your mind. And so we recite in Pali, the words are Imahang Bhagava Atabhavang Tumhakang Parichachami. And we recite that and then translate it. It means uh, Imahang Bhagava Attapavang. I give this, O Blessed One, I give this Attabhava, this self, this being, that of my being. I entrust it into your care. I hand it over to you. So in the Visuddhimagga, in description of this determination, it describes the sort of people who are ideal for practicing meditation, and the kind of people who are ready to die for the meditation. They're ready to sacrifice their own lives. They have such great faith and such great conviction. That's the best sort of meditator, it says. I think you could argue that too much faith could be a bad thing if the person can get stuck on the wrong path and just go with it. But the ability to give yourself up and to detach yourself from your ordinary predilections, your ordinary hang-ups, your ordinary personality, you know, meaning give yourself up. Take your whole being and just plunk it down in the realm of Buddhism. So we make this determination. We say, I give myself up to you, O Blessed One. It's very religious, no? I think it's interesting. It's interesting to note that Buddhism can be very religious if you let it. And I think safely so, because we're not deviating from the path. We're just intensifying it. Intensification can be scary, but it's not always wrong. As long as principles are true, stick to what is right. So we're not deviating from the path by placing our trust in the Buddha. We're just intensifying it and really committing ourselves and saying, "Okay, I really do trust the Buddha." Sounds very religious. It sounds like what Christians would say, but there's a power to it, and a good power in this case. And then secondly, you do the same thing with your teacher. So the teacher will be sitting at the front, and you will say to the teacher, Imahang acharya atabhavang tumhakang parijachami. I give this being over to you, O teacher. I entrust it in your care. I mean, part of this is overcoming the doubts and skepticism, and that really are inevitably in the final form, they're a hindrance. In the beginning, of course, you want to be circumspect and investigate the teacher, but to some extent, at least to some extent, you want to give yourself over to the experience. Now, you can keep in the back of your mind, you don't give up your rational observation and analysis of whether this is actually good for you, but you put some trust in both the Buddha and in your teacher. There's great. It's important psychologically, because too often we have meditators come and they're full of doubts about the practice, and I think it's useful to give yourself up to things. And if you're not, unless you're terribly blind, most of us are we're all intelligent people, and eventually you'll find out whether your trust was misplaced or not. But if you're constantly doubting what you're doing, you'll never have that experience. And I'm not saying this is how you have to go about it, but it can be useful to give yourself up to the religion. So that's the second thing. Then third thing you do is you ask for the kamatana. You actually make a request. We don't go around pushing meditation on others. The Buddha was fairly careful about this, right? And from the very beginning, he wasn't even going to teach. He was He was, in a sense, you could say, stubborn, sticking to his guns. He made a determination that he would just pass away without teaching anyone, unless someone came and asked him to teach. And so we take this stance of letting go ourselves, not preaching, not proselytizing, not trying to convert everyone. We leave the door open. And this is very much in line with the principles of renunciation and letting go, not clinging. So we require the meditators to come and ask for this. Another aspect of this is making it clear that this is something that is being given to you, right? It's not something you deserve or we have an obligation to give you. This isn't a, right? So you go to many meditation centers and they charge you for it. And I've talked several times about how dangerous and problematic that is, because then you feel entitled. The whole relationship is different. I can tell you to, you know, stay up all night, or I could tell you, well, I could tell you to do all sorts of crazy things. But no, but I can tell you to, I can push the meditators, because, well, I mean, I'm not getting paid for this. I don't have any responsibility to coddle you. It really is my way or the highway. To some extent, I mean, we're quite flexible, but it's an important power, and it's a religious power. This coming and asking, beseeching the teacher. Nibbanasa me bhante sacchi karnataya kamatanang dehi. For the purpose of seeing clearly for myself the truth of Nibbana, please, Venerable Sir, give me the Kamatana, give me the meditation. And then my memory is a bit rusty as to the order, but I think the next thing we do, right, so we're ready to receive the Kamatana. We first have to now establish our minds. I mean, we've already started, but we now get into certain meditations that are going to support us and calm us enough to be able to accept the meditation properly. And so the next one is, I think, metta, if I've got the order right. I probably don't. No, we'll go with it. Anyway. Provisionally, the order may be wrong. It doesn't really matter. The next thing would be metta. So you say to yourself, ahang sukito homi, may I be happy. Well, that's why we're doing this, right? And then you can expand upon that. May I be free from suffering. May I be free from enmity, free from sickness, free from grief. And then you say, sabbe satta sukita huntu, may all beings be happy. This is the important part. This is where you begin to settle your karmic debts, settle your cycles of revenge, your grudges, your feuds, your conflicts with other people. Settle your affairs. They make a big deal about apologizing to people, especially enlightened beings. If there's any enlightened being or even spiritual, you know, spiritually advanced person who you've wronged, who you've maligned, you should go and apologize to them. And there's great emphasis placed on this because it can be a hindrance to your path. And this is part of that wishing happiness, settling your thoughts towards all other beings. Whether you've had grudges or problems, conflicts with them in the past, you settle all that here. Put it all aside, you leave that baggage outside the door, and you enter into the temple of Buddhism. right? Very religious. And you give up all your grudges. And then it starts to turn serious. We contemplate death. Aduwang me jibitang. My life is unstable. Duwang maranang. Death is certain. Death is for sure. Jibitang me aniyatang. My life is uncertain. Niyatang maranang. Or maranang niyatang. Death only is certain. This again, what another, you can see the pattern here. We've sort of dealt with the Buddha, and often this will be accompanied by recollections of the Buddha as well. And then we've done metta and now death. This is one of the protective kamatanas, because this one, death gives you conviction. It gives you encouragement. It reminds you, oh yeah, that's why I'm doing this, because all of those defilements I have that I'm building up and all the attachments and addictions, they're just leading me straight to death. And the danger of death is that it determines your birth, your next birth. If you've done bad, you get bad. If you've done good, you'll get good. So we spend some time reflecting on death, at least reminding ourselves. Every time we begin the meditation, this is something that we do, we should do. And again, we've been negligent here at our new center, so we'll have to figure out some way to incorporate this religious aspect into it. Maybe. At least I think we could make it optional, so if someone wants to do it, we could have it available and we could do the ceremony for anyone who wants to do it. There's also a closing ceremony. They're quite beautiful. I mean, the last thing you do is ask forgiveness from each other formally. We'll get to that. So after death, then it gets into the actual, focusing on insight meditation. You make a recollection. Yeneva yanti nibbanang buddha te sancha savaka. Ekayanena magena satipatthana sannina. Which loosely translates into that path by which all Buddhas and all their enlightened disciples have traveled in order to become enlightened is the path of the four Satipatthana, the Ekayana Magga of the four Satipatthana. That's a recollection we do. We remind ourselves, this path that I'm following, this path that I'm undertaking now, this is the path taken by all Buddhas and their enlightened. Anyone who wants to become enlightened has to follow the path of Satipatthana. This is the path I'm entering upon. It's an ancient path. It's a hallowed path. It's holy. It is the right way, the one way, the only way. It is the way to enlightenment. And so we gain courage and encouragement in this way, and conviction and sort of a sense of severity, right? This is not some hobby that we're undertaking. It's not a game that we're playing. This path, this is the path of the Buddhas. And then, am I missing something? Imaya dhammanu dhamma patipatiya. No, imin, I've got it here somewhere, let's go look at it. Oh, I thought there was something else. Anyway, if there is something missing, I'll try and find it. But the last part is Imaya Dhammanu Dhamma Patipatiya Ratanatayang Pujemi. And this is a fairly religious thing, but it relates well to people who have accepted Buddhism as their religion, because we pay respect to the Buddha. We pay respect to the Dhamma, we pay respect to the Sangha. We have this relationship psychologically with the Buddha as our leader and someone who we revere, bringing flowers, candles, and incense to the Buddha statues and so on, thinking fondly and reverentially towards the Buddha, bowing down before the Buddha, etc. We do this. And so this last one, it says, through this practice of the Dhamma, in order to realize the Dhamma, I pay homage to the Triple Gem, to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, the three refuges. And the neat thing about this is it taps into the, or ties into the Buddhist idea that the best way to revere someone, the best way to pay respect to anyone, to the Buddha especially, is to practice his teachings. This is the true way you honor a Buddha. The Buddha said this before he passed away. He said, flowers and candles and incense, that's not the best way to honor a Buddha. And so here's our religious practice. We can consider that another great thing we're doing is we are promoting Buddhism, we are supporting Buddhism, we are engaged in the continuation, the prolongation of the life of the Buddha's teaching in our practice of Satipatthana. Ananda was the one, I think he said after the Buddha passed away, he said, this is it, whether or not people practice the four Satipatthana will determine whether the Buddha Sasana lasts a long time. And so here we pay the greatest and the highest respect to the Buddha through the practice of the four Satipatthana. There would also be in the ceremony, there would have been before this, the taking of the eight precepts, of course. There's actually a formal ceremony for taking the eight precepts. And then after this, the last thing that we would do is ask forgiveness from each other. So all the meditators would bow down to the teacher and say, Acharye pamadena dwaratayena katang sabang aparadang kamatame bante. O teacher, Acharye, Pamadena Dwaratayena Katang Sabanga Paradang. Any wrongdoing that I have done through the three doors, that means by way of body, by way of speech, by way of thought, out of negligence, out of a lack of religions or lack of religiosity, Kamatame Bhante, please forgive me, venerable sir. And then the teacher says, Ahangvu kamami tumhehipi me kamitabang. I forgive you. You as well should forgive me for any such thing. And this is important because even throughout the meditation course, the meditators can often get very angry at their teacher, and that's okay. They can have bad thoughts and they can make the teacher's life miserable or more difficult anyway. And so at the beginning of the course and at the end of the course, you ask forgiveness. The teacher also is not perfect. May say the wrong thing, may teach the wrong thing, may even present a poor example of the practice, And so they asked forgiveness from the students for not being perfect. It's a great way to clear the air. All in all, it's quite a beautiful ceremony. Very religious. And so the argument I want to make, the whole point of this, is to present the concept of religion to Buddhists or to people practicing Buddhist meditators as not something that should be discounted or discarded. It could be. You can avoid it or minimalize the importance. But you could also take it up, that it could be something palatable to a Buddhist. We don't have to say that Buddhism is not a religion and that religious activity has no place in Buddhism, because obviously there are millions of Buddhists around the globe who would disagree, but I mean, to some extent we consider ourselves a bit elitist as being people who focus on true Buddhism, right? There's a lot of Buddhists out there who don't really practice on a level that we would consider proper Buddhist practice. And I think it's easy to get arrogant and think, oh, well, you know, all of that silly stuff is just culture. That's not real Buddhism. And I think we throw the baby out with the bathwater to some extent. Because the Buddha was, I think, quite religious and promoted a sense of religiosity. And there's definitely a long tradition in the meditation tradition that I follow of taking it quite seriously and making it quite religious in this way, really devoting yourself to it in a very real, in a truly religious sort of way. So there you go. I think this is something that I've never done before, is go through in detail the opening ceremony in a video. So now we have my take on Buddhist religiosity. That's the Dhamma for tonight. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer. What do I think of doing past life regressions? You better go. This is. Sorry, just wait for the meditators to actually go back and meditate before we get into the speculative stuff. Past life regressions. I mean, I don't think about them so much. I think I'm going to take a pass on that one as being one of those things I don't think about and therefore don't have an answer. Why don't I have my meditators listen to questions? Because you all have speculative questions that are just going to make them think too much. The thing is, we're on the internet, you have to remember. And so people ask me questions about crazy stuff. Stuff that I don't want my meditators to worry about. You know, these people are doing 8, 10, 12 hours of meditation a day. Last thing they need is to be talking about politics. One of my meditators doesn't even know who their president is. She's from America and she doesn't yet know. Okay, you've rewarded. What is a good way to remove doubts about rebirth? I mean, I could have entertained that aspect of it, but I'm still not that interested in it. Like, if you have doubts about rebirth, you should say doubting. I've talked about, I think it's important to recognize the flaw in our thinking that after death nothing is the null hypothesis, meaning that it's the default, and there's no reason to think that except if you're a physicalist, which is already taking something you have to take on belief. There's no reason to be a physicalist rather than a you know, biocentrist or a phenomenologist, positivist, maybe even. So if you have doubts about rebirth, I would just say doubting and let it go. I mean, I guess the real point is I wouldn't concern too much about rebirth. You accept, and I think that's a part of religion, is you accept these things provisionally. In the back of your mind you say, well, you know, this may all turn out to be wrong, but I'm going to give it an honest try. And you be clear with yourself that there's no reason, there's no better evidence for after death nothing than there is for after death rebirth or birth again. Because what we see now is a continuation of the mind. To say that this is for some reason stops at death is a claim, you know, and you have to provide backing for that. And the backing, of course, is the idea that the brain is the source of the mind, but that's never been proven. There's no conclusive evidence, and in fact there's counter evidence that shows that the mind seemingly can be active when the brain is not. Anyway, I've talked about all that lots and lots. It's interesting stuff to talk about. It's certainly within the realm of what I should be talking about, so I don't mean to dismiss the question of why in the heck should we believe in rebirth. But I have talked about it quite a bit. When we're overcome with lust and desire for a person, do we simply become aware of the lusting and note it until it reduces in intensity? Yeah, not just the lust, you'll note the seeing and the thinking and the feeling, the pleasure of it, because there's usually pleasure associated with lust. You'll note all of that. I mean, it's certainly not easy. It's not like that's suddenly magically going to make all your problems go away, but if you get good at it, you can change your life, and you can certainly weaken and eventually give up these ridiculous attachments to things that are really disgusting. You know, the human body is certainly not full of sugar and spice and all things nice. What is the difference between wanting to end samsara and vibhava tanha? Someone asked me this just this morning, actually. Is it right to say, the Sri Lankan couple that brought me food this morning asked me about vibhava tanha. Is it right to say that the first case is simply kusala chanda as opposed to greed? I would say wanting to end samsara is at least dangerously close to vibhava tanha. I would say wanting to end samsara is not necessarily wholesome. I'd be inclined to think of it as unwholesome, very subtly unwholesome, but the kind of unwholesome that gets you born in the Brahma realms, the formless realms, vibhava tanha. It's not about not wanting to be reborn in samsara, that's just an intellectual outlook, and it's sort of an aversion, it's escapism. Buddhist practice is about understanding samsara, seeing it clearly. And the result is not an aversion to it or a desire to be free from it. The result is an ambivalence and a disdain, but a disregard for it. A complete and utter weariness or disinterest in samsara. See, the only reason that samsara continues is because we're interested, because we like it or we dislike it. But the goal is to see it, to understand it. Because when you understand it, you see this is useless. Absolutely and utterly without any purpose whatsoever. You just start to get more and more disenchanted is the word. And peaceful as a result, until finally there's perfect peace. These emotions are so powerful and they completely hijack your mind. I have tried the meditation on the disgustingness of the body, but it doesn't help that much. A good one is take the body parts of the person that you find attractive and visualize cutting them up. Visualize slicing them up into pieces. Yeah, but that's temporary. That's just like putting a band-aid over it. It still doesn't stop the festering. No, that's why the Satipatthana are the only way. The only way to overcome things like lust is to see the lust clearly as it is. And all the aspects of it, the pleasure and the experience and the thoughts you have about it. Because it really does. Once you see it clearly, you become disenchanted. You lose viraga, you lose your raga, lust. Yeah, well, if you want to overcome lust, stay away from people who you lust after. It's a good sort of, I mean, that's just artificial. It doesn't solve the problem. It's not the answer. But it's a good sort of stopgap measure. That's why people go to meditation centers. I remember there was one, we were doing courses before in Stony Creek, and there are these paintings on the walls, and one of them is of the daughters of Mara, and of course they painted it where you can actually see their breasts. Originally, I was there when he was painting it, and he originally painted it, this was like 17 years ago, he originally painted it with these women bare-chested, and then the abbot complained, and so he put some sort of gauze, he painted a gauze over them, like a, what do you call, some kind of semi-transparent cloth. And anyway, there was one of our meditators who came and we were giving spots, and we gave him the spot right under this thing, and he came to me all frustrated, and he said, of course I get put right under the, I have to do my walking and sitting meditation right under these sexually provocative pictures of these women. But yeah, you kind of want to avoid that sort of thing. We could set up a charnel ground in Second Life. We could have models, pictures. They should. Buddha Center should have a charnel ground. Place with models of dead bodies with blood coming out and pus coming out. And pictures. You could just sit there and look at pictures of cancerous growths and pictures of cut up bodies. If you do a Google search for cancer, it's quite interesting. The Google image search for different kinds of cancer. Breast cancer is probably a good one. That's an interesting point about virtual reality. You know, you can do things, I mean, obviously in horrific ways you can do things that you would never do in reality, but here's an interesting one, a Buddhist one. We could actually set up a virtual reality charnel ground, and we wouldn't have to kill people, or we wouldn't have to find dead bodies. How would that work? I think pictures would be the best. You could have a room full of pictures to contemplate, photos. I don't think trying to make an actual decomposing corpse, maybe it would work. If we had a corpse that was scripted to decompose when you click on it, slowly, slowly decompose. Dar has a charnel ground. Hey, see, she's forward thinking. Dar has been conspicuously absent. I understand she's gone away or something. It's funny how every time I'm giving talks now, the sim turns dark as I give the talk. It's night now. It's quite the visual. Okay, well, thank you. You've been a wonderful audience. It's always nice to meet up here. I got the regulars, and for those of you tuning in on YouTube, thank you for tuning in. Please share the videos, subscribe to the channel, etc., etc. And then there's also those of you who might be listening in on audio. Well, thank you. Thank you for your patient attendance and your aspiration towards goodness. Have a good night, everyone.